Hi, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I'm Anastasia, and I'm bringing to your attention AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, a podcast for technology muggles, not wizards. My show translates technologies from difficult to easy to understand, and look who joined us today, the real Romy. Today, in my almost solo episode, so we will see how he behaves, we will discuss a very important method in statistics and in artificial intelligence, and this method is called Bayesian networks. I wrote a piece explaining how Bayesian networks work for my Patreon account. If you are interested in mathematical background of this method. And by the way, I'm using an example out of a real life. How can you be sure that if you spot a cat, it might be a lilac white British shorthair, just like Romy? So besides, I will talk about a wonderful book called Rebooting AI. Author is Gary Marcus, and I weekly follow his writing on Twitter or X and on Substack. So finally, I have a parenting snack for you, and I will introduce you to The Moomins by Tove Jansson. I loved Moomins while being a child, and my daughter Catherine adored them so much that she bought a Moomin cup as a Christmas gift for me with her first pocket money. I still have this cup. So, but now let's start with Bayes' rules. So the Bayesian rule is probably the most important rule in data science. It is a mathematical rule that describes how to update a belief given some evidence or having some prior information about this belief. In other words, this rule describes the act of learning. Let me use other words to describe what Bayesian rule does. It describes the probability of something happening based on prior information about an event. And it can also be explained as an approach for expressing the degree to which one believes something based on available evidence. So the mathematical explanation for this rule and the equation will be posted on my Patreon account. And it's not really too complex. Even non-mathematicians will be capable to understand it. The equation has four parts. Let me name those. One is the so-called posterior probability, updated probability after the evidence is considered. Then the second factor is the prior probability, and this is the probability before the evidence is considered. Then we have a factor called likelihood, and this is probability of the evidence given that the belief is true. And last but not least, there is a marginal probability, and this is probability of the evidence under any circumstance. So in my post on Patreon, you can see how Bayesian theorem can be applied on a simple example. And because I write about a British shorthair, I will define whether you can correctly identify a rare breed of lilac white British shorthair cat that you might have spotted when it patrolled your neighborhood. So in my example, I will describe how you get data from a search engine like Google and how you apply it in a Bayesian formula. So once again, don't be afraid. There are some math involved, but actually this is quite straightforward. The Bayesian rule provides a systematic way to update prior probabilities with new information or evidence. In other words, it helps us adjust our beliefs about the likelihood of an event occurring based on the data we observe. And this method allows machine learning algorithms to make more informed predictions and make decisions, accounting for the inherent uncertainty in the data. So decision-making is another crucial impact. And Bayesian networks in AI facilitate decision analysis by incorporating probabilistic inference. Bayesian-driven probabilities of future events are valuable for mathematicians working in insurance companies. Mathematicians who work there have a name. They are called the actuaries, and they develop pricing, or they define insurance premiums, or they determine how much one or another insurance product might be priced at. So how did the Bayesian rule get its name? It's not new at all. It was named after Thomas Bayes, who formulated a specific case of Bayes' theorem in a paper published in 1763, so 18th century. And then in several papers spanning from the 18th and the 19th century, in the early 19th century, Pierre-Simon Laplace developed the Bayesian interpretation of probability. So then came the 20th century, and you might ask whether this rules and this theorem have ever been applied successfully. Yes, they did, but the Bayesian methods were viewed unfavorable by many statisticians. And this is because to work with these rules, so this work required much computation to complete, so a lot of calculations. And now we have powerful computers, and now we have new algorithms like Markov chain or Monte Carlo. So we will discuss those in my future episodes in a simple way. And so with those new algorithms and with new hardware and very powerful computers, Bayesian methods have been seen in evolution. And they have seen increasing use with statistics. And now those rules are being applied across industries and across geographies. So once again, I'm trying to give you some short snacks on AI, which might provide a base, a good foundation for you to navigate the jargon of the field. So Bayesian method is an important method for classification problems, for classification tasks in artificial intelligence. And those tasks, they exist across all kinds of applications. They exist in image recognitions, in language domains. And Bayesian rules played quite an important role in development of technology of a company called Geometric Intelligence. This company was sold to Uber around, I think, in 2016. One of the founders of this company was Gary Marcus, and he's one of the best AI researchers that I know. And now we will come to his own book, Rebooting AI. Gary Marcus collaborated while writing this book with another artificial intelligence luminary, Ernest Davis. Ernest Davis is a professor of computer science in New York. So, and I ask all my students to read this book, as this is one of the very rare examples of quite realistic, very sober views on what AI can and can't do today. So I can't really recommend this read hard enough. And in my eyes, there are five takeaways from the book. So takeaway number one. So any account in the media of some AI system that is either very exciting or very terrifying is likely to be unrealistic. It's likely to fall into this hype category when media or even some companies, which are valued quite a lot, try to push for a hype around the AI technology. So if you read something like this, too much excitement or some very dark scenarios, please read those things with skeptical eyes. Then takeaway number two, this is about deep learning. And deep learning is currently the leading approach in artificial intelligence. And it's really powerful. It carries a lot of narrow tasks, and in those tasks, there's always an enormous amount of relevant data available. So, but deep learning will never lead to human-level AI. So there is quite a discussion happening as I speak on X, or former Twitter, between Gary Marcus and the proponents of large language models and deep learners. And many AI scientists today, including founders of great companies, accuse Gary for being very negative about deep learning and actually hating this methodology. And I don't think that this actually provides some justice to what Gary Marcus really thinks. And he does not deserve a claim of being a deep learning hater. He utilized deep learning when he was doing geometric intelligence, his own company. But he's very clear-eyed about the benefits and some pitfalls of the methodology. So I will talk about those slightly later. So then the takeaway number three, there are real dangers associated with the misuse of artificial intelligence, deliberate or unwitting. But Gary Marcus and his co-author believe that the greatest danger is that the enormous potential of AI, enormous potential for good, might remain unrealized. And one of my solo episodes, I talked about why I am quite reserved against the European AI Act. So my personal fear is that due to this piece of legislation, good companies will leave Europe, depriving the continent from innovating around data. So what exactly is my point of criticism? So this European AI Act, in my eyes, does not solve for any risk in artificial intelligence, which is the very base of many designs of today's AI technologies. But this act introduces additional cost burden to companies that are already fight quite a challenging economical fight to introduce services and products in AI. So they are in a very challenging situation because cloud expenditures of those companies amount to around 25% of the revenue base. And of course, they need to pre-process data, handle data, clean the data prior to processing. And the costs attributed to these activities amount to approximately 15% of the revenue base. Those is not my data. It's coming from Andreessen Horowitz. And this is what Andreessen and Horowitz are seeing in AI companies they are invested into. So then the fourth takeaway. So human-level AI will need to have a rich understanding of a situation and the tasks at hand and have a body of common sense knowledge. So today, those deep learning methodologies aren't allowing for such a rich understanding. So Marcus and his co-author Davis wrote the book before large language models got democratized with the launch of ChatGPT in November of 2022. So if you hear claims today that ChatGPT and its cousins like Bard, so those LLMs, large language models, will bring us human level intelligence, you most probably either have journalists or bloggers who love to excite us with some interesting claims, or who might not have a sufficient technical understanding on what they're writing about. Or the second possibility is that you have in front of you some technology founders who must hype their inventions to keep high valuations of their businesses. So being sober about AI possibilities is tremendously important. And then, so the fifth takeaway, AI can only be made safe and trustworthy through a combination of great engineering, common sense knowledge, human values, and smart regulation. So let me stress now and go back to DL or deep learning and tell you what are limitations of deep learning according to Marcus and Davis. So deep learning is quite often really effective at a task if they're exist, or you can create an amount, huge amount of training data for these tasks. And if the examples that will arise in the future are fundamentally similar to the examples in the training data set. But deep learning works poorly when there is little data you can use in training, or when circumstances change, so the context changes. And the kinds of changes that confuse deep learning systems are, from a human perspective, surprising. For example, you train a self-driving car in one city, and then this training is not quite valuable in another city because everything looks differently. So there might be, for example, a lot of tunnels, or there are mountains. So a reading program trained to read black on white may do badly in trying to read white on black. Deep learning systems are very susceptible to so-called adversarial examples. For example, a small change in a text or in a picture, photograph, for example, that from a human standpoint seems trivial or indetectable. And those little changes might confuse a deep learning system. Sometimes those adversarial changes might occur because cyber criminals use technology to penetrate a certain domain and to fool those systems from performing nicely on what they need to do. And so in a self-driving example, a car, instead of seeing a bush, might see a raccoon. So AI programs of all kinds need to have basic common sense. So current technologies don't have this basic common sense. So a robot waiter serving drinks in a party should know, without being told, not to give a guest a broken wine glass. So this is common sense of all the human waiters, but machines don't possess this common knowledge. An AI program that reads the sentence, "Paul emailed George and he answered immediately," should realize that it was George who answered and not Paul. To do this reliably, AI programs need to have the basic knowledge about drinks, calling, answering, and all the other aspects of everyday life that we all take for granted, because for us, it's all very easy and we are humans. Getting that kind of knowledge into AI programs has turned out to be tremendously difficult. And there's a saying in AI, for AI, everything which is tremendously difficult for humans, like do tons of calculations simultaneously, This is easy. And tasks that are quite easy for humans, like navigating in a foreign city with a map, or recognizing different faces in different crowd situations. So this is really, really, really difficult for artificial intelligence programs. And we argue that a solution will require a number of components. So let me name those components. First, AI programs will have to start with some basic knowledge built in. And certainly, the fundamental properties of time, space, and causality should be embedded into those programs. Probably also some knowledge about physical objects and physical interactions and people and their interactions. So this is the first. Common knowledge should be embedded. Then, second, AI programs will need the ability to deal explicitly with concepts and to reason about the world in terms of the relation between concepts. So this is tremendously important to be capable to generalize and being abstract and produce abstract knowledge from the very beginning. And then third, AI programs need to be structured so that they have a body of knowledge about the world in general that they can call in executing different tasks rather than learn each individual tasks in isolation. So in one of my pieces on Patreon, I am writing about Mom being a linguist. And I'm discussing Noam Chomsky, who has this universal grammar theory. And Noam Chomsky believes that language is an innate framework for any human, which could be proven, so this framework, in a variety of experiments spent from one culture to another. So this general body of knowledge in a head of an infant could turn into learning a language. So being then a native speaker in English or in Hindi or in Japanese. So the AIs might need a kind of an embedded, innate, general knowledge to call on when they learn something new without being forced to learn this general knowledge. So finally, there will be a learning mechanism. So this learning mechanism would be needed, which builds up common sense knowledge incrementally from observing the world and interacting with this. And those things, which are kind of, you know, quite easy for humans and a given for human beings, those are very, very difficult for smart software and smart machines. Let me now go to concerns and pitfalls. So there are many legitimate concerns about artificial intelligence. So they are criminals. They are people with bad intentions. They might be terrorists. They might be criminals. They might be authoritarian governments carrying out surveillance. And those people will undoubtedly use artificial intelligence for their own gain and to do what they want to do. Actually, you can't prevent this malicious use of any technology with the act of legislation. So there is a penal code, a criminal code, and a crime is a crime is a crime. I'm saying I might penetrate a building using a machine gun, or I might penetrate a building because I use AI software to open the locks and to confuse the surveillance systems within the building to alarm security fast enough. So I commit a crime in the first case, and I commit a crime in the second case. A crime is a crime is a crime. And AI technologies are tremendously powerful. And unfortunately, I would love to prevent it, but unfortunately, we need to truly invest in our cyber defenses because we will face more and more attacks. And we will see that data, which is a tremendously valuable good for companies, playing a huge part in evaluation of businesses, that this data will be increasingly under attack. So it will be more, not less. So people they might be civil servants, they might work in commercial companies, they might do non-profit companies. They are used to trust. And so this trust is a good. And I think that in the years to come, this trust might be violated so that the people will learn how not to trust, especially in a digital domain. And unless AI is audited quite carefully, AI will perpetuate existing social biases, as we have seen in many scandals over the last decade. For example, a couple of years ago, there was a highlighted Amazon recruiting program that was unshakably biased against female applicants. And this was not because Amazon as a company was evil. This was because the database lacked female engineers and female applicants. I was talking about gender gap in across societies, and I highlighted the gender gap in medicine. And that was in my second episode of the podcast. So this is around those things where AI can even magnify existing biases and produce bad results for individuals and for the society. So I think that those biases can't be really removed with a piece of legislation. They existed historically and they are prevailing today, but I think this is up to how companies create guidelines on designing AI services and products, and how they actually pay attention that the design happens within diverse teams, so that those teams have quite rich and interesting and different perspective on what they are doing, that they are different voices that can be heard when a product or a service is being designed. So it is quite clear that we need regulation, and Marcus and Davis are in favor of AI regulation. I would like to stress that in my own eyes, we can't be without regulation. So I'm not against regulation per se, but I think that this regulation should be smart. And we need to start with pushing for a real technology literacy among politicians. So last week in my podcast, I interviewed Simon Hirlander from CERN and University of Salzburg. And he said he would wish that politicians invested time to learn about AI and to learn about what kind of wonderful benefits AI might bring to their communities and constituencies. But, you know, sometimes politicians follow some interest groups without thinking properly on what they're doing. And to my knowledge, when European AI Act was in creation, in one quarter, big technology companies spent $140 million US dollars in lobbying efforts in Brussels. And this amount actually exceeded what the oil and gas industry and the pharmaceutical companies spent all together on lobbying with the European Commission. So let me now come back to the potential of artificial intelligence. And this is actually the whole purpose why I write Romy and Robbie and why I do this podcast. Marcus and Davis are quite afraid that the great potential of AI might end up unrealized because people might be either frightened by the dangers and they might be disappointed if some existing AIs, some existing products and services don't perform the way those people expected those products to perform. So then there's another issue which might weigh heavily on the prospects of realization of wonderful potential for artificial intelligence. And this is because AI research fixated on the short-term successes of machine learning will fail to explore other approaches, which might have longer-term payoffs. But they might not be profitable if you look into the development costs and human expenditure and test costs from the short-term perspective. And I can't agree more with both Marcus and Davis stressing this point. We should not forget that some fundamental research from the 40s and 50s and even 30s of the last century resulted in wonderful companies and products which we use on a daily basis. Ultimately, Google is mathematics from the 30s of the 20th century. And AI, so really the basics started in the 40s and the 50s and in the 60s. And now we have benefits. So we must invest in fundamental research, and we must find ways to support this fundamental research, which can't result immediately in some, let's say, low-hanging fruits. In my eyes, it would be great if governments and local governments supported companies investing heavily in AI R&D. And this is badly needed, and we need support organizations which might work behind the scenes, but which are tremendously powerful in producing great AI research. I am thinking now about DARPA, a research branch of the U.S. Department of Defense. And, for example, they are a wonderful institution investing heavily in explainable AI or XAI. So XAI is to be absolutely supported because it gives us foundations on how to explain AI applications and how to look behind the whale, what an algorithm or what a model is doing. So now I talked quite a lot about first Bayesian networks and models, and then deep learning, and the wonderful book of Marcus and Davis, Rebooting AI. And it's now time to move into the parenting snack. So let's go to the moments. I absolutely adored moments while being a child. And I must admit that I returned to moments when I immigrated to Germany while being 20 years old. And back then, I had my first master degree in computational linguistics. I was completely on my own, and I felt very lonely. So when I write Romy and Robbie, Moomins is my shiny beacon of a benchmark. I think often about Moomins, though I acknowledge that I will never hit similar iconic status in children literature. So Moomins are tremendously eternal, and those, I think, 9 books are best books for children and not only for children. So what about those Moomins? What is going on there? Like many great children books, Moomins are about a family. So the family is at the center. And there's this very boyish Moomin papa. And then there's this elegant and serene Moomin mama. And there's their son, Moomin Troll, intending to do good and invariably getting into troubles. Moomins resemble hypos or hypotami type of creatures. Their friends and neighbors and some creatures which inhabit Moomin's house, they are quite intriguing. So Moomin Troll has a kind of a girlfriend, the Snork Maiden. And we don't know whether the Snork Maiden and her brother, the Snork, belong to the same species as the Moomins. For example, Snork Maiden and her brother, they change color to express emotion. This is something the Moomins family never does. Then there's this lucre-loving, visualist creature called the Sniff. And then there's the dweller under the sink. So we don't quite know what this creature is. And here is another creature, the vagabond, Snufkin. He seems quite young in the book, so he's a friend with the Moomin Troll. But actually, his name connotate is crafty old man. This Snufkin is a half-brother of the bonically determined Little Moo, who is eventually formally adopted by the Moomins. Little Moo mom is the mumble, and she has an affair with a jockster. So there is quite a natural history around the Moomin clan. For example, there's this creature Hermulens, and they might be Moomin's distant cousins. Moomin Papa was raised by a Hermulen in the orphanage. And a Hermulen in the Moomin Troll and the Comet gets plunged into melancholy and even depression when he succeeds and actually completes a collection of stamps he was collecting his entire life. So he moves into the depression because he loses his purpose in life, so this collection of stamps. So he became content again only when he found another purpose. After Moomin Troll suggested that he collected flowers and plants. So this Hermulen will make the best herbarium on the planet. And Moomins might have an ancestor, and it's a kind of a Ur-Moomin. And he lives in a stove in a bathing house. So when I immigrated to Germany and I was 20 years old and completely alone, my favorite Moomin books became Moominland Midwinter. And this is a story in which Moomin Troll wakes early from his hibernation. And he's in this strange environment. So he, of course, recognizes the house. He is in his house, but the family is asleep. So he's alone. And then he discovers the winter. He meets the terrifying lady of the cold. And like so many great stories for children, this is a story where the child is thrown into a world without parents. So it's quite interesting to look into the biography of the writer of Moomins, Tove Jansson. She was a highly gifted painter, not just a writer. And when she made the first illustration of the very first Moomin, she attempted to draw the ugliest creature imaginable. But the whole world, and there are translations of Moomins in multiple languages, grew to love Moomins. And this love, I think, is because humans navigate a world as complex as our own. So much of Janssen's personal story can be found in her creation. For example, when she lived and she was born in 1914 and she died in 2001, so the majority of her life happened in an era where same-sex relationships were illegal in Finland, in the majority of the European countries. So she hided some clues about her loves in the characters of Moomins. Thingami and Bob represent Janssen's and her married lover, Vivica Bendler, while the character of Two Tiki is based on the love of Janssen's life, Tuulikki Pietilä. So Janssen wrote two first stories of Moomins. And it was Moomin and the Great Flood, and then Comet in Moominland during the Second World War. And during this war, her own brother was fighting in France. And this is very actually interesting how she reflects on the day-by-day in terrible circumstances in those books. And you can see that no matter how wonderful you are, how charming, and how true your heart is, still terrible things might happen to you and to your family. A great flood might come and destroy all your belongings, or a comet might appear and it will threaten everything which you believe is dear to you. And still, in Moomins, there's always hope. I guess some of my followers on social media know that I dedicated the first volume of Romance Robbie to the children of Ukraine. And parents with a Ukrainian citizenship will be capable to download Romance Robbie and The Secrets of Sleep and get an access to the living appendix to those books for free. I personally can't end the awful war in the Ukraine, but maybe Romy and Robbie can make one or another child smile, and maybe a girl or a boy might learn something that might be important for the future lives. Maybe a Ukrainian boy or girl might formulate a wish to study neuroscience or mathematics or computational linguistics or computer science and go into AI to improve the world around us. And so therewith, I'm concluding the 8th episode of AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie. Next week, in my interview episode, I will talk to a behavioral biologist and discuss what AI field can learn from animal research and animal cognition research. But before we meet again next week, please visit my website, www.romyandrobby.ai. Please consider pre-ordering my first volume of Romy and Robbie series. Those pre-orders mean the world to me, and they help my writing, and actually they fund this very podcast. Goodbye for now, and let's make AI technologies transparent and beneficial for all of us. Thank you for your time.